Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Ryan Scott. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with faculty from the 40th Annual Miami Breast Cancer Conference, featuring updates in the treatment of patients across the breast cancer continuum. First, Patrick I. Borgen, MD, chair of the Miami Breast Cancer Conference, expanded on the importance of holding such multidisciplinary conferences for clinicians. Borgen is chair of the Department of Surgery at Maimonides Medical Center and head of the Maimonides Breast Center at the Maimonides Cancer Center in Brooklyn, New York.
Talking about the conference as a whole, there was many, many great topics and medical crossfires and everything in between that happened at the conference this year. But what were some of the things you were most looking forward to coming out of the conference?
Yeah. So we spend a full calendar year planning this meeting. In fact, the first organizational meeting happens on the last day of the conference. So we finish at noon on Sunday, and at 1 o'clock we start doing not only a deep dive, a debrief on what happened, which is important, but we also begin imagining what next year will look like. So this is a one-year planning process. At the core of it, at the center, is our faculty. And so choosing faculty, matching them with topics that they're passionate about, finding faculty that are good communicators, good educators, that are approachable, that embrace our audience. That's really the art to this meeting.
Laura J. Esserman, MD, MBA, the Alfred A. D. Loremire Endowed Chair in General Surgery, a professor in the Departments of Surgery and Radiology, and affiliate faculty for the Institute for Health Policy Studies at the University of California, San Francisco, as well as the director of the UCSF Breast Cancer Center, co-leader of the Breast Oncology Program for the Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center, and the 2018 Giants of Cancer Care Award winner for diagnostics, discussed future directions for the Phase 2 I-SPY 2 trial in patients with high-risk breast cancer.
Can you provide a brief overview of the key points you want to address in your lecture, and we will go into some deeper questions from there?
So I'm going to talk about sort of the transition from adjuvant trials to neoadjuvant trials and how the identification of early endpoints has really enabled us to tailor treatment in a very different way, to really understand the biology of breast cancer better, to improve the way we classify tumors, to drive the response rates up over the course of the past decade, and the future really is about tailoring care, less for the great responders, more shots on goal for the people who are not having optimal response, and a framework for how we get 90% of people to complete response without standard chemotherapy.
What is the importance of early endpoints, and how do they go hand in hand with getting patients the most effective therapies for them?
So the importance of early endpoints is it allows you to learn in the course of care. If you operate first and take out the tumor, you're taking out the biomarker. You're removing the tumor and therefore removing your ability to understand what's happening. And the problem with adjuvant therapy is that we took out the tumors, we gave everybody the same treatments, and assumed that everyone would respond the same, which of course is not true. And we know that from the neoadjuvant setting, where we leave the tumor intact and discovered that some people respond well and some people don't. So the early endpoint means that response to therapy is really important. It allows you to pivot if someone is not having the right response. It turns out that complete pathologic response, PCR, is a great endpoint for faster growing tumors, so for molecularly high risk tumors. Not for everyone, right? So you have to know for whom that early endpoint works, but for those fast growing high risk tumors, it's an excellent endpoint. The hazard rate for EFS or distant recurrence free survival is like 0.18. It's a great early endpoint. And why is that important? Because it really helps you get an early look. By 6 months, by the time someone finishes therapy, you have an idea is that an effective agent? And is it an effective agent for a group of patients? That is an effective agent for an individual. So not only does it help you learn about which agent should be used and for which tumor types, it also lets you learn how to individualize or tailor for patients. Everyone talks about personalized medicine, but the way to personalize is to come up with that early endpoint and to be able to pivot both in the face of a great response and the face of a poor response. How do you pivot with a great response? Well, you can do less therapy. So that's what I-SPY 2.2. Our next phase of the trial is allowing us to de-escalate therapy in the setting of great responses and to serially escalate in patients who are not having as optimal a response as we would hope.
Regarding I-SPY 2, can you expand on the goals of the trial and what patients are being evaluated?
Yeah, so our goal, you know, is to get all patients to, you know, have better outcomes. By better outcomes, we mean more effective therapies that are less toxic, and to do so in a more timely way to get these therapies to work. So it's a platform trial. It's ongoing. So it gives us the opportunity to continue to add new agents in a series of ways. So block A, we're looking at non-standard chemotherapy, so targeted agents that have the chance to get people to complete response, you know, without standard therapy. So we do three blocks of treatment, block A, block B, block C. So block A, these are the novel therapies. If you get a complete response, great, you can go to the OR. If you don't, you know, then you would get assigned the best treatment for your particular response predictive subtype. So we use MRI, functional tumor volume, and biopsy when appropriate to predict who's going to have a complete response. But importantly, if someone doesn't look like they're having an appropriate response, by 6 weeks, we have a strategy where you can escalate early and move on. So I think people are willing to try new things, especially patients who are interested in less toxic therapies. But you have to have a ground rail. You have to have a way to be able to say, okay, I've tried. This does not look like it's going to be responsive enough. So we have developed standards and strategies to be able to say, okay, this is not a sufficient response. And we've tailored that to the type of tumor, right? So that's important. And over the last 12 years of running the trial, because we required everybody on the trial to have a biopsy where we could generate, you know, molecular profiling, we've been able to recategorize or come up with a different tumor classification system. So it turns out, for example, hormone receptor positive in the high-risk setting is many things. There's actually about a third that are more basal-like, that respond, that have an immune phenotype, that respond just like a basal cancer would. And, you know, then there's some that are just not very responsive. So you don't want to mix those two. So we found a better way to sort out how to assign people different therapies, which is very exciting. And I think this will allow us, you know, to really move the field forward. And there are a lot of things that we assumed that turned out not to be true. So we're letting the data teach us. Overall, we started out at about a 19-20% overall complete response rate. But by assigning the right patients to the right combinations of therapy, and we believe that we can be at least 60%. So that's very exciting. And what we also hope is that some of these agents that are very effective, you know, they don't have to be perfect for everyone, but if they're at least have a 40% complete response rate, that we can get these drugs to the market. I mean, the whole point is, if you can get there with less therapy, that's pretty exciting. I know from all the patients I take care of, that's what they want. Better therapies, less toxicity.
Looking to the future, how are you hoping to see the use of early endpoints further integrated into clinical trials?
So I think clinical trials should reflect the way we want practice to be. So our clinical trials really have to allow us to incorporate these personalized approaches. So trials should look more like care, and care should look more like trials. I think also we're looking in the endocrine positive patients who have molecularly low risk but clinically high risk disease, and are working on testing some of the new and exciting endocrine agents. And what we're looking for is the right early endpoint, because we have to find it for those slower growing tumors. And again, you don't want to wait 10 years to find out whether they've had a recurrence, because that kind of knowledge turn, that's way too slow. So we're looking for circulating tumor in the blood, in the RNA, and the DNA, looking for background enhancement on MRI, looking for functional tumor volume, looking at PCR, all the combinations of features, trying to find out what could be that driver that would tell us, okay, I'm on the right track, or no, I'm not on the right track, and so then I can change. So we have this endocrine optimization pilot. So now anyone who has a stage 2 or 3 breast cancer, regardless of their molecular phenotype, has an option to be in the trial. And, you know, we should learn from every patient we see, which is great. And I'm also working on the same kind of framework for DCIS. A DCIS should be considered a window of opportunity for prevention. But if we just keep operating on everybody and doing the same thing we've always done for the last 3 decades, we cannot expect to have a different result. So same thing, if we can give endocrine therapy or some of these things in this high-risk setting of invasive cancer, we certainly can do it in the setting of DCIS, which isn't cancer. It's a risk factor for getting invasive cancer. Again, it's an opportunity to learn that trials need to take innovative approaches. And I think when you take a step back and say, is it risky to wait? Of course not. If you can do it for invasive cancer, you can do it in a much lower risk setting and learn. You know, and everyone doesn't want surgery. And many people probably don't need it. We're probably way over treating it. We haven't figured out what are the right treatments. That's why early endpoints are just so important. They allow you to learn at a pace that is much faster and much more informative. And so you put one trial in, you're learning, you've got the next one in mind, and you've got a whole pipeline of things that you keep learning and keep learning and you keep iterating until you figure it out. You're not going to get it right the first time, of course not. But over time, that's one of the things that the I-SPY trial shows us, that over time, you can make really substantial progress.
What would be a main takeaway for colleagues based on what we spoke on?
I think the main takeaway is that we should aspire to better, that we want better treatments for our patients. And by better, we mean more effective, more targeted, and less toxic. And that the biggest mistake we can make is standing still. And that I think we want to avoid over-treatment, we want to avoid under-treatment, and the only way you can do that is with early endpoints and careful follow-up and making sure that we do our best to learn from everybody that we take care of. And that's the point of platform trials. They help you learn in a communal way, in a collaborative fashion, and accelerate knowledge turns to bring those better outcomes to our patients. So hopefully that's the way we'll make the scourge of breast cancer much less.
Is there anything else you're looking forward to hearing more about over the weekend while we're here?
So I'm going to start my plenary lecture today reminding people that given the trend of states to deny and ban access to reproductive rights, I think all of us need to stand up and be advocates for our patients. We are women's health providers. We cannot sit idly by and watch these rights be taken away. They're fundamentally discriminatory to women, all women, but especially to women who are economically disadvantaged. And if we want and deserve our patients' trust, we all need to stand up and make sure that these rights are not taken away from women.
Kelly K. Hunt, MD, FACS, FSSO, Professor and Chair of the Department of Breast Surgical Oncology in the Division of Surgery at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, discussed considerations for axillary reverse mapping for the reduction or prevention of lymphedema in breast cancer.
Can you provide a brief overview of what you're hoping to impart to colleagues with your lecture, and then we can go into some deeper questions from there?
Yeah, so I'm talking about the considerations for axillary reverse mapping, which is a technique that's been around for a while but hasn't really penetrated the surgical community as much as I would hope. And part of that is because I think a lot of people are trying to avoid axillary lymph node dissection, which causes lymphedema, and that's sort of the best role for axillary reverse mapping is to use it at the same time that you're doing the axillary lymph node dissection. there is more data now that it prevents lymphedema, and so I think doing it up front rather than waiting for the patient to get lymphedema and then trying to do some corrective surgery like lymphovenous bypass, you know, it doesn't work as well. The results are not quite as good. So we're using axillary reverse mapping in more of a preventive fashion up front. But there are several considerations in terms of the technique that people need to understand before they start incorporating it into their practice.
Is there anything you'd want to add on the importance of axillary reverse mapping and what the technical considerations of this approach are?
Yeah, so first of all, I think that when it was introduced initially, it was an approach to use radioactive, you know, isotope in the breast to delineate the sentinel nodes that take up the radioactive dye from the breast. And then the blue dye is injected in the upper arm to delineate the blue nodes that are draining the arm. Now, unfortunately, sometimes there's crossover. Sometimes the breast node is also the arm node. And so that's when I think some of the newer considerations are important, because we don't necessarily want to leave those lymph nodes behind if they're draining the breast tumor and could have disease in them. And so some of the things that people are doing now is to spare the lymphatics from the arm, but to take the nodes and then to do reconstruction of the lymphatics. There's many different ways to do that. You can do lymphovenous bypass using microvascular anastomosis, which is more technically challenging. You need a microscope to do that usually. And you can also do reapproximation of the lymphatics with branches of the axillary vein. And that's been shown by some to be very effective. There are trials that have recently been completed looking at this preventive strategy of doing axillary reverse mapping with different lymphatic reconstruction techniques, and we need to wait for the data on that. Of course, we have to have follow-up data to see how many patients do get lymphedema. And in this recent randomized trial from the Alliance for Clinical Trials, the patients were randomized to get axillary reverse mapping or standard axillary surgery. So we'll be able to see from that data how well it prevents lymphedema. But there are many other studies that have been published over the last year or two also showing reduction in lymphedema rates using axillary reverse mapping at the time of the initial surgery.
Is there anything you wanted to add on how this can affect the prevention of lymphedema and why this is so important?
Most of the data on lymphedema and when it develops in patients is not prospectively collected data. A lot of it's retrospective analysis of things. So everyone's idea of how much lymphedema we see in our practice is different. And it depends on whether you actually measure it, whether patients report symptoms. There's quite a bit of variability. It also is impacted not only by the surgery, but also by the use of radiation. And so we do have data showing that from the Z1071 trial that was prospectively collected, these were all women who had node-positive disease, then received neoadjuvant chemotherapy, then had axillary dissection, and many of them had radiation as well, that at 3 years, almost 60% of the patients had lymphedema. You have to look at the patient population, whether they're node positive, node negative, what type of surgery they're having, what type of radiation they're having, but lymphedema rates can be quite high. And so I think we have to consider that when we're preparing a patient for surgery and considering whether axillary reverse mapping can be incorporated at the time of the surgery.
Can you expand on the increased awareness needed surrounding best practices for prevention and screening of lymphedema?
Yeah, so there are national guidelines. The Lymphedema Network and others have developed guidelines that many people are not aware of. And I think also because breast cancer is a multidisciplinary sport, you know, I think that it's incumbent upon us to decide who's following the patient and who's doing the measurements and assessments. Because if someone develops lymphedema, then interventions earlier can be more effective. If the patient develops very advanced stages of lymphedema, it's much more difficult to treat. It's more problematic for the patient. They can get problems with infection in the arm, cellulitis, even requiring hospitalization in some cases. So it's important for all of us in our practice to know what type of axillary surgery the patient's had and what the risks are and when we should be assessing them at different time points, but it should be part of their ongoing assessments in survivorship.
What would be a main takeaway message for colleagues based on what we spoke about?
If you're a surgeon, there are different techniques that can be done, and that's one of the things I'm going to be talking about at the Miami Breast Cancer Conference, is what the literature is showing in terms of increasing the identification rates, because technically it does add a little bit of a challenge. Lymphatic channels are not very big. The surgeon has to be carefully looking for them, and you have to be able to leave enough length on the lymphatic channel for some type of reconstruction in order to make that work and actually be effective. So I think what we're learning now is that there are combination techniques that you can use. Some people are using like a fluorescein dye in addition to a blue dye and other things, but the success rate is higher with more experience. So it's like many other things in surgery. Once you've done a few procedures, you start to get more success with it.
Is there any other presentations or talks, anything like that you're looking forward to hearing more about?
Yeah, well, the medical crossfire that I'm doing with Dr. King from Boston is looking at targeted axillary dissection. So in those patients who have smaller volume axillary disease, where we're not doing a complete axillary lymph node dissection, what is the best technique for that? Do we use sentinel lymph node alone? Do we need to clip the nodes and then target them with some type of device so we remove that clipped node? And I think the debate is going to be very lively.
Kevin Kalinsky, MD, MS, an associate professor in the Department of Hematology and Medical Oncology at Emory University School of Medicine, director of the Glenn Family Breast Center, director of Breast Medical Oncology, and the Louisa and Rand Glenn Family Chair in Breast Cancer Research at the Winship Cancer Institute of Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, discussed how to best sequence antibody drug conjugates in patients with triple negative breast cancer.
To kick things off, you're presenting on sequencing therapy for metastatic triple negative breast cancer. So to start, can you provide a brief overview of what you're hoping to impart to colleagues with your presentation, and then we'll go into some deeper questions from there.
For patients with metastatic triple negative breast cancer, we have seen some recent advances. For patients who have PD-L1 positive tumors, which is about 40% of the population, we give those patients chemotherapy and immunotherapy, specifically pembrolizumab. We also have sacituzumab govitecan, antibody drug conjugate for patients who have triple negative breast cancer. There are chemotherapy options. If patients have germline BRCA mutations, there are PARP inhibitors. And then for patients who have HER2-low breast cancer, we also have trastuzumab deruxtecan.
How has the space evolved in previous years with the addition of new agents and therapies?
You know, I think the biggest advance recently for patients with metastatic triple-negative breast cancer has been the addition of trastuzumab deruxtecan for patients with HER2-low metastatic breast cancer. That's defined right now as 1+ or 2+ based upon immunohistochemistry and being gene non-amplified. And there was a smaller subgroup of patients that were in the DESTINY study that led to the approval of trastuzumab deruxtecan for patients with HER2-low breast cancer. And so one of the things that we'll talk about is just how to best sequence the ADCs, given that sacituzumab govitecan was approved and showed an overall survival benefit, specifically in patients with triple-negative breast cancer, that tends to be the preferred initial antibody drug conjugate. And we'll talk about where the field is and the limitations of an absence of data that we have right now about sequencing antibody drug conjugates.
And then how do you approach sequencing strategies based on patient characteristics?
When we have a patient who's newly metastatic, one of the most important things that we do up front is that we check for PD-L1 status. And that is done based upon available tissue. This can be done in the metastatic tissue, and if that's not available, then we reflex to looking at primary tissue. We do not do this in lymph nodes. We do this, you know, if it's in the primary setting on the breast tissue. This is done by the combined positive score. If patients have a score that's 10% or greater, that's when we give pembrolizumab frontline. Again, it's about 40% of patients. And then the other important characteristic and thing that we should be looking for is to do germline testing, you know, make sure that patients don't have a BRCA mutation or even a POBI2 mutation. Because, for instance, if patients have a germline BRCA mutation, these are patients that we may think about giving a PARP inhibitor based upon the large randomized trials.
Additionally, you're participating in a molecular tumor board. What are you looking forward to from this mini symposium?
The Molecular Tumor Board is a new addition to Miami Breast. I think that this really reflects where the field is going, that things are increasingly complicated, whether it's next generation sequencing that we're doing, germline testing that we're doing, how to best incorporate this into the clinic. For our patients with metastatic disease, we just saw approval for patients who have ESR1 mutations about giving them elacestrant. We have agents that are targeting the PI3K/AKT pathway. So I think that this is demonstrating that we're increasingly moving to precision medicine, and that's reflected in the fact that we're having this molecular tumor board to talk about not just genomic assays, but also next-gen sequencing and germline testing.
What steps are being taken to address unmet needs across this treatment landscape?
I think based upon the tumor subtype, there are different unmet needs that we have. For patients with triple-negative breast cancer, there's been a real advance, even in the early stage setting with immunotherapy. But for our patients with metastatic disease, there remains this unmet need for having new targets and new drugs. We've made advances, including with the antibody drug conjugates, but there's more that we need to be doing for our patients. And also for patients who receive neoadjuvant chemotherapy and potentially immunotherapy as well. If they have residual disease, they're in higher risk. And so identifying new ways of decreasing recurrence, like with antibody drug conjugates in this space, I think will hopefully move the field forward. For our patients with HER2-positive breast cancer, we have agents that target the CNS, the central nervous system, and that's been a nice advance, but I think hopefully we'll be utilizing these agents earlier to also help even prevent the tropism that we can see to the CNS. And for patients with hormone receptor positive HER2 negative breast cancer, I would say in the metastatic setting, there's a huge unmet need for having targets and drugs beyond the context of having endocrine sensitive disease. Once patients have endocrine resistant disease, it can be a very hard disease to treat. I think the other important thing is for patients with early stage breast cancer, one of the most common questions that we get is how do I know that I'm not at risk for recurrence? And this is where the potential role of circulating tumor DNA may come in, not just prognostically, but also predictively. And so there are ongoing studies that are hoping to answer that question, and that has the potential, I think, to really move the field forward for that subtype of breast cancer, but potentially other subtypes as well.
Is there anything in particular you're most looking forward to hear about this weekend?
You know, I think for Miami Breast, one, it's a attractive symposium and conference for lots of different disciplines, right? There are talks here that are reflected by surgeons and radiation oncologists and medical oncologists. It's a very multidisciplinary sort of meeting. And I think that that's one of the things that makes it unique. It's also very patient-centered. And, you know, we discuss cases and how we manage these patients. It's a very practical conference. I also think that this is a great time for us to just be talking about some of the advances that we're making, including in medical oncology with some of the new drugs. I think it reflects how quickly the field is changing. And that's why this sort of meeting is just really important so that we are able to keep up to date and best treat our patients.
Lisa Carey, MD, SCM, FASCO, the L. Richardson and Marilyn Jacobs Prior Distinguished Professor for Breast Cancer Research and the Deputy Director of Clinical Sciences at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill Breast Cancer Clinical Research at UNC Chapel Hill, UNC Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center discussed how response-guided therapy can be used to tailor HER2-positive breast cancer treatment.
Can you begin by setting the stage and giving a brief overview of what you hope to impart to colleagues with your presentation?
I had the pleasure of talking about response-guided therapy in HER2-positive breast cancer. This is in the non-metastatic setting. And, you know, it's a particularly nice topic because, in truth, we already do response-guided therapy in HER2-positive breast cancer. So I could talk about the fact that we can minimize surgery through neoadjuvant therapy. We can tailor
the use of more aggressive drugs like trastuzumab emtansine, predicated on if they have residual disease or not. Patients who have pathologic complete response can actually do very well without additional therapy. And we talked a little bit about ways in which we're already moving forward. So there's the COMPASS trials, two NCI trials, COMPASS PCR, which, if it is successful, it will allow us to take a de-escalated regimen of THP, only one chemotherapy drug, and if a patient achieves pathologic complete response, even if they started as a larger or node-positive cancer, they don't have to get more chemo. They can get by with one chemotherapy drug. So if that's successful, that will be another step towards response-guided and tailored therapy. The COMPASS RD trial is sort of the flip side of it, which is in the high-risk residual disease, we're adding tucatinib to trastuzumab emtansine. And we'll see if that can help with those higher-risk patients who still have about a 20% relapse risk.
One of the standards of care for patients with HER2-positive breast cancer has been to give chemotherapy and or multiple anti-HER2 drugs for long periods of time. So what tailored efforts have been utilized in an attempt to address this need? And I know you highlighted some of them, but are there any else you'd like to talk about?
The only group that we don't already do response-guided therapy is very small node-negative tumors. All the rest of them, we give neoadjuvant therapy, and we predicate additional treatment on response to that. As I mentioned, we have the COMPASS trials. Those COMPASS trials are actually, I think, really important for the next steps of de-escalating when the cancer is very, very sensitive, and escalating if it's more resistant and needs more drugs. We talked a little bit about some of the imaging approaches. There's a trial, a European trial called Fair Gain. And in that trial, they took patients who, half of them got traditional polychemotherapy plus HP, but the other half got only HP with endocrine therapy if they were hormone receptor positive. After two cycles, they did a PET scan. And if the PET showed response, that early marker, they could continue on HP alone. And if that is a successful trial, that's actually a mechanism for using an all biologic regimen, like no chemo at all. That would be pretty transformative. So we'll see. They demonstrated already that about 40% of the patients using that approach can get to a PCR. If they're sensitive, according to the PET scan, stay on HP for 6 to 8 cycles. It's a reasonable pathologic complete response rate. So I think that's the kind of thing. The other things that are coming are biomarkers. There's a biomarker called HER2-DX, which built on some research that we and others did, and it looks at immune activation, it looks at intrinsic subtype, and is trying to integrate all of these features that we know are really important in how HER2-positive breast cancers respond to therapy.
Looking to the future, are there any other advancements that you're hoping to see in response-guided therapy in HER2-positive breast cancer that we haven't highlighted already?
I think the truth is that right now we're pretty good, but we have basically one tool, which is neoadjuvant therapy, PCR, yes, no. I think the future absolutely is going to be within neoadjuvant therapy, more adaptive approaches, but those have to be tested. But I'm pretty excited that either a combination of biomarkers and maybe response by imaging may give us that early look before you get to surgery so that you can actually be more sophisticated than we are right now.
What was a main takeaway message for colleagues based on your lecture and what you talked about?
Because of trials that have demonstrated the safety, we already do, I think, a good job with HER2-positive early breast cancer in terms of the medical therapy facilitating less surgery, which is really good, and facilitating the thoughtful use of drugs. And we have to build on it even more. We give a lot of therapy to these patients, and we know we're over-treating many of them. So the efforts to try and get even more level of rationality to how we treat HER2-positive breast cancer, I think will be for our patients' benefit. And many trials are going in that direction.
You also participated in a medical crossfire on sequencing ADCs and hormone receptor-positive metastatic breast cancer. Yeah. Can you expand a little bit on what your positioning was during this medical crossfire?
So Dibu Tripathi and I talked a little bit about the rapid, emergence of antibody-drug conjugates for hormone receptor-positive, HER2-negative metastatic disease. We have now two drugs that are approved in the pre-treated setting. So for, clearly, you should be endocrine resistant, so the best treatment for these patients upfront is endocrine-based. But when you start to get to the chemotherapy, the point of using chemotherapy, the tools we have now include these antibody-drug conjugates, specifically trastuzumab deruxtecan, or TDXD, and sacituzumab govitecan. So we talked a little bit about the trials and who would be good patients for these. And basically, it's pretreated patients. I think in the audience, there was general agreement that most people, when they get to chemotherapy for these patients, the first thing they give is usually capecitabine because it's oral and it's a little bit easier. And then after that, you've got, you know, TDXD is more tested in that next line, and sacituzumab after that. Dr. Tripathi and I don't vary that much in what we believe about the use of these drugs. So we talked mostly about, you know, the nuances of how do you choose these patients and where do we think the future's going in terms of ADCs after ADCs. And if chemotherapy is all going to be given in this way, we're going to have to start thinking about the nature of the payload and the resistance mechanisms. You know, you've got the target, so the antibody target, and you also have the drug payload, the cytotoxic, and you can have sensitivity and resistance on the basis of either of those. And so we had a spirited conversation about where we think that's going in the future. But it's actually a really exciting time because, you know, most patients end up getting chemotherapy at some point, and we want it to be the best chemotherapy, the most efficacious, and the least toxic.
Stephen J. Chumara, MD, PhD, a professor of radiation and cellular oncology, and a professor of medicine at the University of Chicago, as well as the medical director of the Comprehensive Cancer Center and clinical and translational research for radiation oncology at UChicago Medicine in Illinois, discussed management strategies for patients with oligometastatic breast cancer.
Can you provide a brief overview of what you're hoping to impart to colleagues with your presentation, and then we can go into some deeper questions from there?
I think it's now been over 25 years since everybody's been talking about the idea of, in patients who have like limited metastatic disease, could we use some type of local therapies, radiation or surgery, to then improve their overall outcomes in terms of like progression-free survival and overall survival. So in 25 years, a lot has been said about this. It is commonly sort of done based on a lot of sort of single institution series and retrospective type of data. So I think the entire point of the Energy BR02 trial was to really design a good phase 3 trial to actually test if this intervention actually helps or not. And I think it was exciting at the time because it was really the first trial to really test the hypothesis, could local intervention actually help? So it has been 25 years now, and we have a lot of data, we have a lot of the publication, and we have a lot of hopes, but what can we actually say we can do in 2023? What impact does local therapy actually have? And what do the results of the BR02 trial, which is a negative trial, actually inform us going forward? And really, is there a path to go forward in terms of these local interventions?
You noted that this is a negative trial. So how has that helped inform practice now, and how do you hope it will inform practice in the future?
I think it's important to point out that the trial was in first-line metastatic disease. It was almost entirely ERPR positive, HER2-negative patients who then had very small volume disease. Interestingly, this is the exact population of people who then all of the retrospective studies suggested could be really helped. And then ultimately, the intervention failed to improve either overall survival or progression-free survival. So I would hope that people sort of look at this well-stratified, well-conducted trial and sort of like it take home that off-protocol use of these local therapies, which could in fact have significant toxicity, should probably stop.
How do you anticipate this approach affecting any future treatments?
There has been so much written about this and so much promise. I think there is plenty of room to do other clinical trials to investigate other areas. If it's in the HER2 population, if it is in more of the patients who initially present with metastatic disease, all of these trials are currently being sort of worked on now. I think that the trial we conducted answers the question that I think a majority of people are currently treating now, so we know probably not to do that. But I think the future trials are going to ask more specific questions.
What would be a main takeaway message for colleagues based on what we've discussed here?
I think if there's a patient who then has a solitary metastases, which is not causing a problem in terms of pain or in terms of a compression or impending problem, that we should probably not do local therapy and move forward with systemic options.
What is the importance of continuing to host conferences and gatherings such as these for the clinicians and faculty?
At the rate that breast cancer is changing, these meetings become so much more important. There are meetings that highlight strictly research, and there are meetings that highlight basic sciences, and we're in the middle somewhere. We're you've heard us say, hear it Friday and use it on Monday, and we embrace that. I think the importance of Miami in the next 40 years is actually going to be incredibly high.
What would be, I guess, a main takeaway message for your colleagues that you'd like to impart based on our conversation today?
I know that I've spoken to dozens of our attendees, and we've talked about cases, and we've talked about difficult choices and decisions. I've met with our faculty. We've had working groups behind the scene. The lectures have been spectacular, concise, focused, and incredibly practical. So I learn something every single Miami. So if you've not attended Miami, think about joining us next year. Join this incredible meeting. I promise you, you'll thank me.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletter. To read additional coverage from the meeting, visit www.onclive.com/conference/Miami Breast. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you're there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.